One, I think it's immoral. I think it's wrong. We did a moratorium, but the voters, the state of California, have advanced a principle of requiring that population to do work that they haven't been able to do the current facility, and that's why we're reimagining the future. And so we're in the process now of pushing that population out of the row, the physical death row.
Governor Gavin Newsom this week announcing his plan to get rid of death row at San Quentin State Prison and turn it into a, quote, positive and healing environment. Newsom's plan would move San Quentin's condemned inmates to other maximum security prisons over the next 2 years. San Quentin has the largest death row population in the nation, around 700 prisoners. California hasn't executed anyone in more than 15 years, and Newsom has signed an executive order suspending executions, but a future governor could reverse that. So what does this all mean for the future of the death penalty here in California? Here to discuss is Hadar Aviram. She's a law professor at UC Hastings. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi. All right, so tell us about how San Quentin came to host this version of death row, why it is the largest in the nation.
San Quentin is a strange facility. It has a history that starts with it actually being a ship rather than a prison. In the mid-19th century, the prisoners themselves built the prison, and they built a facility which is now largely standing, so they're still using the original 19th century buildings. It's a dilapidated facility. There are no solid doors. There are bars on the doors. Ventilation is terrible. So it's a facility that was built for 19th century standards, and just because of inertia, we are still incarcerating people in the same conditions.
All right, so what do you make of his announcement that he wants to close death row and make it into a more humane place? Why is he doing this now?
I think there's a lot of things going on here. I think it's probably important to start with a bigger context, which is some of our listeners may not know this. San Quentin is located in a place that is very geographically beautiful. San Quentin Village is on the waterfront. It's probably extremely expensive real estate. And over the years, there's always been talk of closing San Quentin and selling that land. Houses there are pretty expensive. It's a really beautiful area. And in many ways, a waste to have a prison there where people don't enjoy the sea view and are incarcerated in terrible conditions. At the same time, we've had a moratorium for 2 years now over the death penalty. So we are not actually executing people. And in fact, the death chamber itself has been dismantled. There are some DAs in California that are still asking for the death penalty in active cases, but there's less and less of that happening. And largely the moral impetus behind doing that has gone down because, as many listeners probably remember, we recently caught the Golden State Killer, who is likely the most heinous criminal in the history of California, and he got life without parole, which sort of raises the question, well, if not him, then who?
Right.
Since 1978, when the death penalty came back, we executed only 13 people. More than 100 died in for natural causes during this time. And just during the moratorium, which I think is probably the more immediate impetus for this, just during this moratorium that Governor Newsom introduced, more people died on death row from COVID during the horrific outbreak at Quentin than we executed since 1978. So I'm sure that is giving some pause about sort of the utility of the exercise of keeping people there.
Yeah. Well, it also says something about the conditions overall in the prison, which are probably not great when it comes to preventing a communicable disease.
Absolutely not. I mean, generally speaking, we've had a correctional disaster with COVID-19 in the state, but Quentin suffered most other prisons because the facility is so old. The transfer that initially started the outbreak at San Quentin included people that were also brought to Corcoran, which is another prison where people are also held in solitary confinement conditions. But there wasn't as big an outbreak in Corcoran because that's a modern prison with more ventilation. So Quentin was really a place that was poised to suffer the brunt of this. And it also houses a large number of people that are aging and infirm and doing lengthy amounts of time. And because of that, we're already compromised and vulnerable when it comes to disease.
All right. Well, let's talk about the death row situation and capital punishment in general when it comes to what California voters want, because they approved a ballot measure back in 2016 to actually speed up executions. I guess another provision in that ballot measure allowed people on death row to be moved to other prisons where they could work and pay restitution to their victims. So what is it that the voters want? Do they want what Governor Newsom is doing, this moratorium and closing death row, or do they want the capital punishment to continue?
So this is actually an excellent question that I think all of us need to ask ourselves. Over the years, there have been several attempts to try and abolish the death penalty through voter initiative, and they've always lost by a small majority. And inquiries that we've done and polls and talking to people have led me to realize that people are voting for the death penalty largely for emotional, sentimental, political reasons. They are sort of more in love with the fantasy of having a sentence that's reserved for the worst of the worst and can deter people. In the sort of California imagination, there are some serious crimes that are looming large. I'm thinking about the Manson family. I'm thinking about Sirhan Sirhan, who was recently denied parole. So there's this concept that kind of like in the imagination that this is what death row is going to do, rather than at what death row actually does in California, which is basically a more expensive version of life without parole that costs us $150 million a year. So I think that the idea here is this idea of administrative cost saving, like there's really no need to maintain this facility that costs a lot of money. And it's one more step toward the demise of the death penalty, which is already in decline nationwide. I think it's probably a good idea to think of the death penalty as undergoing the same process as some of the people who have been sentenced to death, which is rather than an execution, the death penalty is going to die a slow, natural death itself, just from disuse and from this gradual dismantling.
It couldn't be revived by a future governor, a more conservative governor?
There's always something that can be done. And one of the we know that the death penalty did come back in the 70s after a few years of moratorium then, after a Supreme Court decision and a California Supreme Court decision. So in California, nothing is impossible. And there are some DAs who continue to ask for the death penalty in capital cases, even though we don't actually execute people anymore, with the hope that at some point another governor might, you know, reassemble the death penalty and revive this tradition. I think that because of the national trends, I wouldn't say impossible, but it is extremely unlikely that it's going to come back.
So what is going to happen with this new reimagining of death row that Governor Newsom announced, calling it a positive and healing environment? What does that mean?
So this is one more piece that moves people toward living more of the kind of life that long-term prisoners live in general population. So a life in which you find some meaning, you are of some use, you do some work, rather than just basically sit and wait for the execution that's never going to come. And in that respect, this is a positive thing. I think there might have also been some thinking around the pandemic and around the fact that overall, you know, Quentin is really not a facility that's fit for the 21st century, and we need to start thinking about doing something else with that real estate. So maybe that's part of the thinking as well. But the idea is, yeah, moving people to general population. I will say that this does not completely do away with the death penalty, because there is still one very big and expensive piece of the death penalty that is still with us, and that's death penalty litigation. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned earlier that we spend $150 million on death row. This is just 700 people in a correctional apparatus that has more than 100,000 people incarcerated, right? So we're spending all this disproportionate energy on these folks when there's a much bigger system going on. But the point is that there's this population is, we have this facility where people are sentenced to death and are still litigating themselves post-conviction. And that litigation is actually the lion's share of the expense. So it's only really going to go away if and when all of those sentences are commuted and these people are no longer litigating their death sentences at the state's expense. So that is the missing piece. But it is true that even though it's not most of the expense, a big part of the expense involves the confinement conditions. And that's going to change if people are moved out of Quentin and into general population in other facilities.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Hadar Aviram. She's a law professor at UC Hastings. Coming up, why there is a big fight over solar power here in California. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. California loves to brag about how it's leading the nation in addressing climate change, which makes what I'm about to say a little surprising. Right now, state regulators are weighing a plan to make rooftop solar panels more expensive. And this plan has touched off a big fight between the solar industry and most environmental groups. On one side, they say it will kill a thriving industry and threaten California's ambitious clean energy goals. And on the other side are the utility companies, labor groups, and consumer advocates who argue the state's current program slashes energy bills for the rich while making poor people pay more. Sammy Roth covers energy for the Los Angeles Times. Hi.
Hey, Madeline.
Wow, so this is confusing. Who isn't involved in this fight? Seems like everyone
It covers
has an
every aspect of our state politics. It's very intense.
Right. Okay, so why is there this plan? Who's floating it to do this?
Yeah, so this is a proposal that's actually been put out by the California Public Utilities Commission now, which regulates the big utility companies, particularly Pacific Gas and Electric and Southern California Edison. And the PUC is a bunch of people appointed by Governor Newsom. And they've put forward this plan that, you know, as you said, is responding to these concerns that have been raised by the utilities and by labor and by some consumer advocacy groups who basically make the argument that when people who are able to go solar, who are predominantly, you know, more affluent, are able to lower their electric bills through this technology, through this incentive program, net metering, that as a result of that, they're sort of not paying their fair share of the costs of maintaining the power grid, and that those costs are getting passed on by the utility companies to people who are less affluent and not able to afford rooftop solar.
Okay, so explain this idea. This all centers around net energy metering, and this is when you create more power than you use and you can sell it back to the utility, right? Is this where they would exact the different prices, like they would lower the price that you'd get for the amount of energy you send back to the utility?
So that's one of the things. Right now, when you generate more electricity than you need, you export that into the power grid, and the utility is required to pay you the retail rate for electricity, the same rate that you would pay them for electricity. This is a proposal that would dramatically reduce the compensation rate. It would also add these monthly charges for people who go solar in the future. That would be $8 per kilowatt of solar. So for a typical, say, 6-megawatt system, you're looking at about $50 a month in additional charges to go solar.
So why are labor groups saying that this is unfair?
So the labor component is really interesting. What we're really looking at here is labor unions that represent utility company employees and also unions that represent electricians who build, you know, big solar farms out in the desert and in, you know, farmland and other places. They basically see rooftop solar as a threat to them. I mean, it's, you know, if it undermines the utility business model and the business model of, you know, building big centralized power plants and, you know, utilities sending people that energy, they see that as potentially a threat to their jobs. And also the rooftop solar installers who are, you know, putting panels on homes and businesses are for the most part non-union businesses. So that's part of where this divide forms.
So the Public Utilities Commission, whose members are appointed by the governor, want to make these changes. And what would they look like?
The two main things would be reducing the export rate, what you get compensated for the solar you produce, and adding these monthly charges of somewhere around $50 a month. It would take effect for new customers, so people who are adding rooftop solar in the future. However, for existing customers, there would be some change. Right now, you're allowed to stay on the current net metering program for up to 20 years after you install. For most homes, that would be changed to 15 years. So you'd have some folks who would be forced to switch to the new, less generous program sooner than they expected.
And would this really discourage people from putting in solar?
I mean, I think there's pretty good evidence that it would. I think it's a question of discourage, I should say, relative to, you know, to how encouraged they are now. So there's an analysis that just came out a couple of days ago from an energy research firm called Wood Mackenzie, and they did some projections, and they found that the amount of solar being installed on rooftops in California would be about half of what it would have been otherwise, without these changes, if these changes are in fact approved. There would still be plenty of people, or many people, I should say, going solar, just likely not as many as before.
So the environmental side is saying this is going to crater the industry. Is that accurate, or is it a little?
Well, that's the question. It's really hard to say. There are some analysts who look at this and look at what's happened to the stock prices of these rooftop solar installers, for instance, which have gone down a little bit, but not a ton. And they say, well, we don't think this is going to be that big a hit to them. And there are others like that analysis that I mentioned and what the companies themselves are saying. And they're saying this is going to be a huge hit and there are going to be folks that go out of business as a result. It's hard to predict.
What about this idea that it would encourage people to install their own batteries to capture the energy rather than sending it back to the utility?
So that's definitely part of what the Public Utilities Commission is saying they're trying to do, that by reducing the amount that people get paid for sending their excess solar power into the grid, that's going to be an incentive for people to also make this investment in batteries where they can store more of their energy on site and use it themselves in the evening, which would be potentially very good for them, good for the power grid as a whole, an important climate measure. There are also incentives in this proposal that's been put out by the Public Utilities Commission to encourage people financially to add batteries if they've already got solar. It's a question of how well that will or won't work. Batteries are still relatively expensive, especially compared to solar panels. It's a big additional investment. I think you would definitely see more people installing batteries if this was approved than you would have otherwise, but how many, and whether that makes up for some of the gap of less solar, it's again hard to say.
Is there a fear that if you have a bunch of more well-off people doing that, then the cost of maintaining the traditional grid would be pushed onto people who couldn't afford it as much as well, the poor people? Who can't afford to install rooftop solar?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what this whole debate is about, because right now utility companies are spending all sorts of money on things like, hardening the grid against wildfires to prevent wildfire ignitions, and discounts for lower income households, and investments in clean energy and large battery installations, paired with solar farms. And those are things that everybody pays for through their electric rates. So, in every form of this argument, there's this question of, If wealthier people can afford to lower their bills through these solar incentives, are those costs getting shoved off onto anyone else? There's a lot of debate around that point. There's debate around accounting for the benefits that rooftop solar brings. There's debate around, are there other ways to make this more equitable besides reducing incentives for everybody? Could you target incentives more specifically towards low income? This is what's being debated actively at the Public Utilities Commission as they decide whether or not to approve this proposal.
So this seemed like a done deal before there was all this uproar over it, and the governor hasn't really weighed in on this. So where is he on this, and where do you see it headed?
Well, the governor finally weighed in publicly for the first time a couple of weeks ago when he was doing his budget press conference. He was asked about this, and he basically said he'd reviewed the decision, there were changes that needed to be made, and they were going to work on that. Public Utilities Commission is nominally an independent agency, but appointed by the governor, and he, in fact, just appointed two new members to the agency, including making his energy advisor the president of the PUC. So he's definitely going to have an influence here. The thing is, he's facing real political pressure on both sides, because he's got the solar industry and the bulk of the climate change activist community on one side pressing him not to do this. And then he's got organized labor, which is obviously very politically influential in California, pushing him the other way. So it's not totally clear to me how he's going to navigate that.
Sammy Roth covers energy for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Coming up, why you should ditch your gas stove.
80% of the methane leaking into the air happened when the stove was off, and it didn't matter whether the stove was new or old, also surprisingly.
The case for going electric and what a professional chef thinks about that. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, home chefs, cover your ears because your gas stove is a problem, a polluting problem. Around 40 million homes in this country have gas stoves. They emit methane, which is more powerful in the short run than carbon dioxide. So basically, the amount of dangerous emissions from all those gas stoves equals the amount emitted by 500,000 vehicles every year. And most of those emissions come when the stove is turned off. This is all according to a new study in the journal Environmental Science and Technology. Rob Jackson is one of the authors. He's a professor of Earth System Science at Stanford, and he's here now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay, how does my gas stove pollute when it's turned off?
What we found surprisingly was that 80% of the methane leaking into the air happened when the stove was off. It's probably loose fittings, couplings, valves, connectors, things like that. And it didn't matter whether the stove was new or old, also surprisingly.
Yeah. How would I know if it's emitting all this methane?
Well, you probably wouldn't, depending on the ventilation in your kitchen. The concentrations were relatively low. If it's fast enough, and in some houses, we could smell it. But that's not common.
And all told, what does all this mean for the environment? How dangerous are these gas-powered stoves?
Well, we found that the Environmental Protection Agency is systematically underestimating the climate impact of gas appliances. We found this not just for stoves in this study, but for water heaters in our previous study a year or two ago as well. So they're creating or releasing a lot more greenhouse gases than we thought before. They're also releasing indoor air pollutants. We measured NOx gases in this study. And one of the NOx gases is nitrogen dioxide. It's an irritant. It can lead to asthma, coughing, wheezing, and difficulty breathing. And we found that the amount of gas that you burn, the higher that was, the more gas you use, the more NOx you breathe. We also found the concentrations of NOx in some cases, in small kitchens in particular, rose above kind of safe threshold levels, sometimes within only minutes of use.
When it comes to indoor air health, does it help to have a range hood or some kind of ventilation in your home?
It definitely does. Now, I tell people I never used to use my range hood before we started these studies, and now I always do. I would encourage listeners to turn your hood on every time you turn your oven or a burner on in your home. But all hoods aren't created equal. Some hoods vent to the outdoors. Other hoods simply recirculate the air and blow it back into the kitchen without a filter or a scrubbing mechanism. All they're really doing is diluting the air into the environment. So ideally, you should not only have a hood, but have a hood that vents the waste gas outside your home. However, that's not to say that we should continue doing it forever. I'm particularly interested in cases where we can incentivize switching from gas to electric appliances every time a person buys a new stove or water heater, or there's a new home or building built. Those are the cases where we really need to not put new natural gas appliances into homes and buildings, because then we lock emissions in for decades to come.
And that is true in lots of cities here in California, correct?
It is true. Cities that include San Francisco, San Jose, Oakland. But there are now about close to 50 cities and counties in California that have such incentives. And it's not just California. New York City passed a similar law just a month or so ago. They now require electric appliances in buildings starting in 2027, not existing buildings, but new construction.
Well, I guess when you're thinking of all of the carbon emissions and all of the factors and who is emitting what, when it comes to cars, when it comes to power plants, all sorts of things, where does this fit in the continuum when you're talking about the biggest contributors to global climate change?
The biggest contributor of greenhouse gases in the United States is transportation. It's our cars, trucks, vehicles that we use. And then the next biggest source is, I believe, is power plants. So that would be coal and natural gas plants. Appliances and homes are below those two categories in terms of the amount of greenhouse gas emitted, but they all matter. We need to get to net zero as quickly as possible. And that includes heating our homes with furnaces, cooking and heating our water too.
Right. And so that would get to the power plants, right? And the natural gas industry.
Well, I think it depends on in the area where I live, PG&E supplies not just natural gas to homes and buildings, but electricity. So they've actually come out in support of electrification. For instance, the initial bill that was passed by Berkeley, and has been copied for a number of cities like San Jose and San Francisco, they were in favor of that bill. They have something to gain on the electricity side if they lose something on the natural gas side. So it's not quite a simple black and white issue. Mm-hmm.
If you can afford it, would you recommend replacing your gas stoves with induction?
I definitely would. I'll say it again. I especially encourage it anytime someone's buying a new appliance or new construction is going in. And there are people like myself who are better able to afford it. I mean, people in lower income communities, not only are they less able to afford replacing a stove, they also have smaller kitchens and perhaps lower quality ventilation systems, so they're more at risk. There is an environmental justice component to this work, too.
Yeah. So maybe there are incentive programs out there or being considered?
There are an increasing number of incentive programs being considered. It's an interesting mix because for some cities now, especially as they electrify vehicle fleets and such, that they've realized that they can't reach their climate goals without tackling building emissions using natural gas.
And the new induction stoves, they're not like those old coil electric stoves of my youth.
Oh my gosh, not at all. I think we all have horror stories of being in some rental home or some camp where you have one of those old coil electric burners and you might as well pull your book out when you turn the pot on. The electric induction stoves are much faster to boil water than gas stoves are. They're quite remarkable.
Do you have one?
I have a portable one. I still have a natural gas stove in my home, although we're very interested in electrifying all of our appliances we plan to. And I hope other people feel so inclined too. Electrification makes indoor air safer to breathe and it helps cool the planet. So we stopped burning coal in our homes decades ago. It's time to stop burning gas indoors too.
Rob Jackson is a professor of earth system science at Stanford. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, gas stoves are still beloved by both home cooks and professional chefs. But if you're thinking about switching to an induction, you may have some questions about just how well it works when you're cooking. Here to walk us through it is Chef Susan Feniger, and you probably know her from her restaurant Border Grill. She has one now in Las Vegas, also Socolo in Santa Monica. Hi, Susan.
Hey, how are you?
I am fine. How are you? And what do you think of this whole idea of switching from a gas range to an induction? It seems like whenever you see restaurants, either on TV or in real life, chefs are sweating over the high heat and the flames, and it looks so dramatic, and it seems like they would be the last to switch over to induction.
Yeah, I mean, I mixed feelings about it. I can't say that I'm the expert in induction cooking at all, but certainly I've cooked on it enough when I've done demos or in kitchens that, aren't set up with big hoods and gas burners. But I think there's tons of benefits to the induction burners. I mean, we don't have the experience of using them day in and day out. You're not seeing it a lot on Food Network. It's just not part of our everyday doing, but there certainly are tons of benefits to it for sure.
Okay. So let's get to the benefits and then get to some of the possible minuses. What are the benefits?
Certainly the induction burners are extremely fast. And so, you turn the burner on, you put the pan down and your pan gets heated up very, very quickly. So, if you have chopped shallots or chopped onions and you put your induction burner on, not even on the highest heat because they'll probably burn too quickly, but it's very quick. So certainly I think it's more efficient. You're not heating up all the air all around the burner. I think, when you're cooking with gas, you put the gas on, it's heating up the pan, it's heating up the air around it, as we know in restaurant kitchens and even in your home kitchen, it starts to get hot in there.
Yeah.
Well, with induction, it's basically the pan. That's what's getting hot and the food in the pan. It's not all the air around it. I mean, that's planet friendly is a huge thing, I think, for us, certainly. And I think many chefs and many people.
And you won't burn yourself, right? If you touch it,
I mean,
the stovetop.
If the pan is off the stovetop, it cools down way, way quicker, and it turns off almost immediately. So, I mean, certainly the pan and the food in it is still very hot. So you could tend to burn yourself, but not in the same way as an electric burner or a gas burner and the, you know, grill on top of the gas burner. Those stay hot for a long time. So the likelihood of burning yourself, certainly the likelihood of, you know, anything like if you have a scarf on or a sleeve, anything, catch a towel catching fire, that's not going to happen. So in that way, absolutely.
What about the technique and the finesse of controlling the heating? If you want your pot of soup to go from a royal, like a big heavy boil to just a simmer, you kind of, you know, chefs finesse it, turn the flame down. Do you have that same kind of control with an induction?
You do have that control. You probably have it almost even better. But I think if you're used to cooking on gas, you have to get used to it, because I think, you know, I mean, I think some of those induction burners have where you can sort of move it with your finger to a little bit lower heat. And, but if something was at a boil and you felt like it was going to boil over, if you lift it right up off the stove, it stops it right there. So the likelihood of it overflowing is probably less likely. So yes, there is for sure the control. So once you're used to it, it probably is more efficient than a gas burner. But if you're not used to it, you might go where you lift the pan up and now it turns off and now you got to put it back down and then it boils quickly. So, you know, I can imagine that could get a little frustrating for someone if you haven't, if you're not comfortable using it and you haven't gotten used to it yet.
Can you use all of your same cookware on it as you can with a gas stove?
You know, no, I think, I mean, that's probably, I think, the biggest challenge right now for cooks is that most stainless steel, I think you can use on it. Cast iron, I think you can use on it, but not all pots and pans can be used on it. So I think if you have, you know, pans that are bent and curved from the heat and they're rounded bottoms, those really won't work on induction. But if you had like a kitchen refrigerator magnet and it stuck to the bottom of your pan, then you would know that would work on an induction burner. But
right,
you know,
it
like
works by magnets.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, if you had to replace your cookware, that's not cheap. If you get a high quality cookware, that's not cheap to replace those.
So you haven't switched in your restaurants?
No, we haven't. We haven't.
And why is that?
Well,
just the cost issue?
I mean, yes, cost issue. And I mean, cost issue for sure. I mean, we've got, you know, at Border Grill in Las Vegas and at Socolo in Santa Monica, you know, we've got, I don't know, maybe 16 burners there that are gas burners. So for us to replace everything and the ovens and everything, that would be a cost factor that we, particularly now, given COVID, you know, if it's not an investment we'd be making. And we would probably have to replace all of our cookware, all of our pots and pans. And so I don't think that it's a consideration at the moment. And also, you know, when none of us are used to it in that way, you know, our way of cooking in restaurants are, which isn't environmentally the best thing. You know, we, we put, you know, 20 pans on with heat so that they're hot. So when an order comes in, we're ready to saute with hot pans. So, you know, it's just a whole different way of cooking. You also are constantly, you know, when you're sauteing, you're constantly shaking the pan. And, you know, with induction burners, you'd have to be really worried about scratching the glassware. You would have to go through a lot of training with your team. But on the flip side of that, you know, Mary Sue and I feel that taking care of our environment and being energy efficient is really important. So it's a discussion we've been having is if we, you know, open up a smaller space where we were going to do one of our concepts, a taqueria or barbecue Mexicana, you know, would we go forward and go with induction burners? And, you know, I think that's something we're looking at very seriously.
Susan, always great to talk with you. Good luck with the cooking and maybe the changeover.
Maybe
the new world.
It is. It really is. Well, I hope to see you soon down at Socolo.
Yes. Susan Feniger, co-chef and co-owner of Socolo and Border Grill. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much.
Coming up, an all-Latino cast in a TV show all about Latinos. The creator of Promised Land, Matt Lopez, is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, and that means it's time for TV on the Radio.
The crown has landed on my head.
Yes, queen, yes.
You're not a killer.
This is the way.
You have to be a killer.
There was an offered before me.
If you're trying to curse, you can't.
That's bullshit.
We have so many disasters bombarding us right now.
Well, today, a new show that takes place in California's wine country, Promised Land, tells the story of Joe Sandoval, a man who worked his way up from nothing to become the owner of one of the top wineries in the country. But the way he earned his fortune still haunts him. His kids fight for their share of his money. His ex-wife wants to take him down.
You think I wronged your family because I took the little vineyard your father started and turned it into one of the largest wine producers in the country.
I think about my father on the day he died. Broke, sleeping at the bottom of a wine bottle. He was half dead before he ever got behind the wheel of that car that day, and I blame you, Joe.
Joe's family drama might remind you of the Ewings from the 80s hit show Dallas, but there's a big difference. The cast, the family, the show's creator, they're all Latino. Promised Land is one of the first Latino-led dramas on major network TV, and joining us to talk about it is the show's creator and showrunner, Matt Lopez. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. Well, tell us more about who Joe Sandoval is and more about his family and his business.
So Joe Sandoval is the chairman of the board of Heritage House Vineyards, which, as the clip suggests, is the third largest wine grower in the country. He's a self-made man who's come up from nothing. And the show is very much about both the beauty and the occasional ugliness of the American dream, and how there's a cost to achieving it, and sometimes an even greater cost to maintaining it, a cost to your own self and your own personhood and to your family. And Joe, through the course of season one of Promised Land, is wrestling with many of those issues.
Hmm. And why set it on a winery?
The way the project originated, I had been thinking about doing a show about a Latino family, and somehow in my travels, I had missed East of Eden, Steinbeck's East of Eden. I had seen the James Dean, film version, but I hadn't read the novel. And then I read it with my daughter, and I was just captivated. And what's interesting about East of Eden is if you reduced it to just sort of a log line, it's like a 10 o'clock network show. There's two brothers, their mother is the town prostitute, but they don't know it. And then one brother finds out, and can he tell his other brother? And there are these two families. So it's absolutely like plays in those very soapy waters. But at the same time, in terms of what it's going for, in the depths of its characterizations, in the richness of its themes, it's going for something much bigger and greater. And I thought, that's a really cool idea and a rich palette. And the California of it all and the connection to the land, and vineyards are just gorgeous. I didn't realize it at the time, but after the show got picked up to series, one of the network execs said, yeah, we've actually pretty much every year for the past 10 years, we've bought at least one project set on a vineyard, but yours was the first one that really clicked creatively.
So you have two brothers at the center of it, Joe and his brother, and they sort of replicate the Cain and Abel story in a sense?
They do very much. They have the decided misfortune of falling in love with the same woman. Promised Land, spoiler alert, basically it shows us the immigrant journey at two different points along the timeline. So we meet these brothers initially when they are quite young and quite you know, fresh to this country, and they have different versions of the American dream, but over time, those paths will not be a straight line and will be complicated by many things, including the love of the same woman, who at different times along the timeline will marry both of them.
Ooh, spicy and soapy, as you've said earlier. So how much of the of this is Dallas-esque?
You know, it's, I think, sort of the stealth thing of the show is it delivers the goods on all of those soapy elements. There are twists, there are turns, there are reveals, there are cliffhangers. There are beautiful actors, cars, and homes, and vineyards. So it checks all of those boxes in a very fun and entertaining way, if that is the kind of show you respond to. But I feel very gratified that the show also works on this other level of story. And in terms of portraying the immigrant experience, we talked about Steinbeck before. Another inspiration for this show is Dickens. I like to think that Dickens wrote television because the fact is many of his great novels, or what we consider his great novels today, were not written as novels at all. They were written as serialized weekly stories, and he would he would purposely write himself into jams and cliffhangers and then sort of delight both himself and his readers in figuring out ways to get out of them. And I love that mode of storytelling, and I'm not going to sit here and compare myself to Steinbeck or Dickens, because I wouldn't, that would be crazy. But that mode of storytelling, combining these very soapy, as you say, elements with deeper themes. And look, the Latino family and the way this show looks at the immigrant experience and what it means to be an immigrant and how to make it as an immigrant is obviously an element that Dallas, you know, which was this well-ensconced Texas family, obviously could not do.
So why has it taken so long to tell the story if this, if we are a nation of immigrants? I mean, why are we now in 2022 just now getting a network drama based around a Latino family?
That is a great question. I don't think it's any great sort of racist conspiracy. Let me start by saying that. I think the television audience is not nearly as monolithic as it used to be. With the rise of streamers and the rise of premium cable, you see many shows that are not necessarily aiming, and their bar for success is not tens upon millions of viewers, because very, very few shows get tens of millions of viewers anymore. There's also a recognition on behalf of the studios and networks, there's a more of a risk taking. And I commend ABC and ABC Signature, which is where the show will air on ABC and stream on Hulu. I commend them for the risk that they're taking with this show.
So you say it was a risk, but there's a huge audience. ABC or NBC rather bought Telemundo for nearly $2 billion back in 2001. So
yes,
there's a huge audience out there that has money to spend.
There are tens of millions of members of this television audience. And there's been great reporting in the Wall Street Journal, among other places, about the special appeal that that audience has to especially network broadcasters, because it is a young audience demographically. It is a rapidly expanding audience. It is an audience whose socioeconomic means are expanding as well. Compared to other demographics, a much larger portion of that audience still watches TV when the show is on and watches the commercials. And to the extent that ad rates on Univision and Telemundo are rivaling and sometimes exceeding the rates commanded by the big three networks, because the networks, are the advertisers, will pay a premium for a person who's actually watching the show live.
So how do you want to portray this family? Because I guess in some way, since this is the first show like this, there's a lot on your shoulders or a lot to carry in terms of representation. So what kinds of conversations are you having in the writer's room?
It's a responsibility we feel. And then to a certain extent, I think creatively, you have to recognize it and then ignore it. The way we as creators, including the writers and us, the cast also has been hugely important in this, is to just make it as true and real and grounded as possible. There was a lovely letter that the cast wrote during this horrible 2-week period, which most showrunners experience, which is, we're waiting, are we going to be picked up to series? And the cast, unsolicited by me, wrote a collective letter to the network. And one of the things they talked about is, because almost the entire cast is Latino, which is so different from the usual experience of most of these cast members, where they're the only Latino, they're the Latino character on some other show. Here, they're on a show with other actors whose life experience, whose cultural background, whose language, et cetera, you know, bears at least a great degree of like commonality. And what that did is, as actors, it felt like it relieved them of the burden of representation. Several of my actors have relayed to me that on other shows, when you're the only Latino character, they feel like the producers almost feel obligated, like, well, we don't want to delve in stereotype or cliche, so let's make sure the Latino character is like really above board and upright. And they end up being like less interesting as a result. Here, because the entire cast is Latino, it freed them and liberated them to be just human beings in all their complexity and messiness. In the casting of this, it snuck up on me, to be honest, in the casting of this show, there were actors who responded to the characters and mm-hmm. would say, thank you for showing an unapologetically, unmistakably wealthy and successful Latino family that's not in the cartel. Because the sad truth is, we would see it come in, like you just see these actors one after another, and you're looking at their IMDb pages, and it's cartel, cartel, cartel. And that's where it sort of hit me, like, wow, we have a responsibility to do something different here. And to, if anyone ever pitches me, or very early on when I was interviewing writers for the show, they'd be like, what if the Sandovals get involved in? And I'd be like, I'm going to stop you right there. they're not going to deal drugs. They're not going to be involved in that. An element of danger in the show exists, but it's not going to come out of those tropes.
Yeah, I mean, it's like not every Italian drama has to be about the mafia.
Right. Simple. Some really good ones happen to be, but yes.
Right. You have to have The Godfather after all. But not everything has to be The Godfather.
Yes, yes.
So you, as I understand it, were a lawyer for a while, an entertainment lawyer.
Yes.
And you were writing scripts on the side.
Yes, it's true. I was a mergers and acquisitions lawyer in a law firm. And then I was a business affairs person, exec, and entertainment lawyer for DreamWorks in the early days of that company. So I worked on the business side on movies like Saving Private Ryan and American Beauty. And what I was doing is, that was my day job, but every morning I was writing feature scripts from like 4 to 7:30 every morning. And I did that for about 5 years.
But you don't want to go back to being a lawyer. Full, I mean,
you know, it's so funny, Madeline. So I got an email from the California State Bar saying, hey, send us your $150 to renew your status. It's just the conservative in me, I guess, was like, oh, I should just send it in. I don't know. I may save the $150 this time.
So how much do you know about wine?
The creator of Promised Land, his dirty little secret is that when this whole adventure started, he was pretty much exclusively a beer drinker. So I have learned an immense amount about wine, and I'm still learning. It is a fascinating world. It's so modern and yet so ancient. There are certain aspects of the winemaking process that are cutting edge and very new. And there are other aspects that have not changed in 6,000 years. I still sample the occasional beer, but I'm learning to love my wine.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Cheers and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Madeline. It's been a delight.
Matt Lopez, creator and showrunner for the new ABC drama, Promised Land. And that does it for us today on Press Play. Don't forget, you can download and listen to our podcast whenever you want. It's at kcrlv.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.